This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jonathan Rendell, knows boxing, and it has inspired his passion and cynicism. As a journalist, he's covered the game and written investigative pieces for British publications and for Esquire and Ring magazines. He also knows boxing from the inside. For 5 years, he managed the British boxer Colin Sweetsea McMillan. Rendell guided McMillan to the World Featherweight Championship. McMillan held the World Boxing Organization title for about 6 months in 1992. Rendell has written a memoir called This Bloody Mary is the Last Thing I Own, A Journey to the End of Boxing. It's published in the States by the literary press Echo. Rendell writes that he wouldn't have wanted to get involved in any boxer's career except for Colin Sweetsea McMillan. I asked what made McMillan so special.
I was just thought he was the one. I mean, every person who follows boxing has one boxer, but he may not ever be a champion or some kid on the undercard, and he just follow. You just follow him, and he's the one, you know. And I was happy enough just watching him, and I knew him because I was reporting on amateur fights, so I knew him a bit from the amateur days. And I just thought he had was tremendous potential. I thought he was the best boxer I'd seen for years. But unfortunately, not many people shared my opinion. And so because of those two things, really, we got and a couple of unlucky defeat he suffered. We grew closer and closer in terms of the likelihood of me getting involved with him. Something I was desperate to do.
How would you describe his boxing style? One of the things you say in the book is that he was self-aware without being self-conscious.
I would describe, he was compared a lot in this country to Sugar Ray Leonard. But he himself actually modelled himself more on Sugar Ray Robinson. He loved Sugar Ray Robinson's style. And he liked Leonard. And he also liked a fighter, South Central American fighter called Alexis Aguello, who's a great lightweight champion of the 70s and 80s. And he liked him a lot. He was called the Thin Man, Aguello. And he sort of melded all those together. And then he added his own things to it. And it was just a beautiful style to watch. It was boxing as I felt it should be. It was balletic, and it was, I found it almost poetic. But of course it needed a foil. I mean, if you had two Colin McMillans in a ring against each other, it might get a bit boring. But you put that style against some guy who wants to tear your head off, and you've got the makings of a classic boxing match. And the great thing was that he was so slight that everyone thought he was going to get sort of completely annihilated, but he almost always prevailed.
When Sweetsea McMillan and his manager went separate ways, you stepped in and took over the job of manager, first informally and then more formally. So what was it like for you when you first started calling promoters trying to set up fights for him?
It was actually surprisingly easy. And looking back, I think I had the advantage that I was working as a sports writer at the time, and as a boxing writer within that. And so probably they were a bit wary of me in the sense that they knew they couldn't really screw Colin or me to the extent they could the others, because it would, you know, although obviously a conflict of interest, I couldn't write about Colin. They knew that I would, you know, possibly use it or pass it on to someone. And so it was, as soon as we got going, getting going was easy, getting the initial fights. It was when he started winning, putting a few wins together, and the perception of him started changing, that it got very difficult to get him fights because no one wanted to fight him.
Because they're afraid they'd lose?
Yeah, and there wasn't a lot of money in it and fighting McMillan, and they were afraid also that a fighter who fought like Colin did, that if you lost to him, you wouldn't only lose, you'd probably be made to look pretty silly as well, and they didn't want that.
You say that sometimes you'd pay to get him on the bill. How would you offer money?
Well, it's not quite as sinister as it sounds. It was just that I thought that it would be great benefit to his sort of fistic education to go to America, because that is where it really is. And so he went over to train, and I didn't have a lot of money at the time. I was working as a freelance sports writer and basically investing sort of about most of my salary in hanging around with Colin. And we went over to New York and we stayed on people's apartment floors and stuff, and he went to Gleason's. But when it came to getting fights in America, no one would give him fights unless he signed a contract with an American promoter for a long-term deal. And so they said, but the only way you could put him on a card was that you pay not only Colin's purse, but also his opponent's purse. And I did that twice with Ace Miller in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And then he fought a guy in Mississippi, somewhere in Mississippi, called Malcolm Rougeau. And he beat him, and they both got paid $500, and Colin got paid $500.
So it cost you $1,000?
Yeah, it was on my overdraft. I don't know, I'm laughing. I'm in terrible trouble. But but he was being. I wasn't actually out there, you see. I wish I was, because it would be good material. But because I had to work to sort of get the money together. And then I sent the money out to an American trainer who was training out there called Bo Williford, whose real name was Mabon George Williford IV. Who trained some fighters in Monroe, Louisiana, and so I sent it out to Bo, and Bo, I was covering Wimbledon at the time, and I rang him on the payphone from Wimbledon between sets, and finding copy, and then you know to check he got the money, and he said fine, I got the money, so that night he could go off and fight, and thankfully won both fights.
Did you find that promoters in the States functioned any differently than promoters in London?
I thought they were more honest in a way.
In the States?
Yeah, they told you exactly why they wouldn't put your kid on that TV or why, in very explicit terms. I went to, whereas here they'd sort of say, yeah, we'd love to use him, but then they wouldn't. Whereas I remember one, I was in Las Vegas and I went and saw one major promoter. And he said to me, you know, I think this kid is a great fighter, but the problem is we got too many. I said, what do you mean you've got too many? He said, we've got too many black fighters with this fight with this fancy style. What we really need is a white kid at the moment, a white kid who goes down several times but then gets up to win. So I'm sorry, but, you know, he just doesn't fit the bill. And I just thought, I was obviously fairly astonished.
It's more like they're casting for a show.
Yeah, absolutely, which is what they're doing, really. But, you know, that was, I think, however unpalatable, the truth of the way they were selecting them, and probably is in England too.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up. Did you find that race was treated any differently in England than in the States?
In boxing gyms, the race didn't really play a part. Everyone is just struggling to get there and fulfill the dream, you know. But the difference was, say, in New York compared to London, I found in London that, I mean, I hung around with Colin socially as well, and in London, you know, black people, white people, any colour, doesn't matter. There is social mixing, there's not a problem with that, really. Although undoubtedly there is racism in English society. I found it in New York, for example, after we finished the day at the gym, all the Hispanic fighters went back to the Hispanic area, and the black fighters went back to the black area, and the Irish fighters went back to the Irish area. And walking around New York, me and Colin trying to find somewhere, we sort of attracted a bit of attention, you know. Not anyone knew he was a boxer or anything, but just because, and I think that was, that came as a surprise to me. But I think it was more overt in the States, but possibly no less present in England.
And in the ring, any difference racially here and there?
What do you mean, from what point of view, from the what, marketing?
From the marketing.
I think there's... You remember, this is going back to the early 90s, and I think it's probably changed in the States, but at the time in the States, there was still very much a pervading culture among promoters of, you know, we'll promote lots of black fighters, but if we get a white fighter who can fight just a bit, we'll really go with him. And possibly that would be the case here as well. But I don't see it so much here, and I don't know whether it exists still in America.
When you were managing the featherweight champion, and when you were managing him before he became the champion, did anyone ever approach you to throw a fight?
No. It doesn't really... I've heard of a couple of occasions in all the years I was involved that happened, that was done, but it doesn't. You don't need to do it these days because it's all done with the matchmaking. So the fixing is done in a way that you just... If you've got fighter A and he's a real prospect and you want to pad his record out to get a payday after he's had 18 fights, say, and he's got a respectable record and he's 18-0, then you get 17, what are called in the trade, dead men, to come in and be knocked over by him. And the dead men, knowing they're dead men, it's not a question of being told, they're not to be told, like, they know they've got no chance of winning against a good young prospect like Fighter A. And so they take their licks and then that's it. the injuries in boxing tend to happen when you get two young fighters who both want to win as much fighting each other. But as far as the fix being put in, it's not really like, you know, it's not your night tonight, kid, sort of stuff.
Right.
Because it's not necessary.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Rendell, and he's a writer. He's written a lot about sports. He also managed the former world featherweight champion, and his new book is a boxing memoir called This Bloody Mary is the Last Thing I Own. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about boxing. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jonathan Rendell. He's the author of the new book, This Bloody Mary is the Last Thing I Own, A Journey to the End of Boxing. And he's a writer who mostly has written about sports, but he also, for a while, managed the featherweight champion of the world. Would you describe for us the fight in which Colin Sweetsea McMillan won the featherweight championship?
Well, I think I was in sort of state of probably clinical terror. I mean, I don't know what I was. I barely watched any of it. I watched it through my fingers. But he was, when he won the title against an Italian called Maurizio Stecca, who was been Olympic champion, and he came over with this great entourage and posse of Italian journalists, and he was the favourite. But it was actually quite an easy fight for Colin, because he'd worked out, he wasn't worried about Stecca, and he'd worked out how to box. Stecca was a boxer, and so as soon as the first round came, and as soon as Stecca knew he couldn't out-jab Colin, and Colin knew that he could out-jab Stecca, the pattern of the fight was set. And Stecca didn't really have the punch to pull it around. It was just a question of Colin keeping his nerve, not thinking suddenly, as some people do, suddenly around the eighth round, oh my goodness, this is the world title. I've only got to keep going for another four rounds and I'm world champ, and then sort of getting nailed. But he didn't keep his concentration, and he won by wide points decision. And you know, and suddenly the dressing room, which has been empty for five years, apart from you, Colin, and the trainer, the bag man sort of folding up all the stuff, was besieged by about 60 journalists and TV crews and everything, and the whole thing started.
Did that feel good?
It felt rather bewildering. It felt great, obviously. I mean, it was more, I was just relieved more than anything else, because I actually got more nervous before the fights than Colin did. I would be sitting there biting my nails off with his trainer, Howard. And Colin's, the way, I'm sure he was nervous, but the way he dealt with it was, he used to hang around outside, go and see friends in ringside seats, talk to books on the undercard, up till about half an hour before he went on. And then he'd come in the dressing room and go, John, what's wrong with you? And I go, Colin. You know, and then I'd be banished, really. I mean, I didn't stay. I just thought I was probably too much of a neurotic presence for the final 20 minutes, so I went and sat ringside for that.
Were you nervous because of the competitive aspect? You wanted your guy to win? Or were you nervous because you might be watching at ringside while your guy took a beating? You know, were you nervous for him physically, or just, you know, the game?
I was nervous for him physically, actually. I was nervous from the same standpoint. I discussed this recently, actually, with his wife, Sue, and because we used to sit together quite a lot, and both of us with our hands over our heads. And it was just watching the other guy's hands. You didn't even watch Colin much during the fights. I did that on the video. Watch the video later. But you watched the other guy's hands, and you saw them arcing towards Colin, and then you just thought, you know, I hope, you know, that's not going to hit, is it? Is it? Is it? And then you'd look, and he hadn't hit him. And he was dancing away, and he was peppering the other guy with jabs and whatever. But sometimes it's difficult. You see, it was a matter of sort of millimetres that Colin would not get hit by often, particularly when he was on the ropes, because he was very old-fashioned, which he got from studying films of Ray Robinson. He was one of the few fighters who could really, or British fighters, who could fight off the ropes. And that position was very hard to tell what, as he flinched with each blow, whether it actually hit him, had it hit him on the arm, or had it got through to the rib cage, was he hurt? You know, and so you would sit there in a sort of state of suspense, really, until it was over, and then you'd have this tremendous feeling of relief.
Now, when he won...
Well, the times he won, you would.
Yeah. When he won the World Featherweight Championship, what were you supposed to do to build on that success?
Well, it was all in place, really. Everything would have... the hard work had been done in the ring, you know, and out of it. American TV was interested. He was going to be on ABC television. And he was being featured on the cover of Ring magazine in the States. He had ascended to a sort of completely new pay bracket. And all he had to do was get over this first defense of his title against the number 10 ranked contender. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. So it was remained tantalizingly out of reach.
Now, what happened in that fight?
He got beaten. But what happened was, he his shoulder, his dislocated shoulder in the seventh round, and obviously couldn't continue and had to retire from the fight. And really, he never recovered from that.
You make it sound in your book that you noticed that Colin's arm was out of the socket before he even realized
it. Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah, but the adrenaline, I mean, he's in a world title fight, and what happened was that he didn't, you know, his eyes were always on the opponent. You can't take your eyes away. Or even if you're pretending you are looking at the floor and doing some mugging trick, you know, you're not really looking at the floor. You're sensing where he's going, the other guy. And he must have just poured out a jab with the hand that was now useless. I mean, it was hanging from his shoulder, but from the socket. And neither, thank goodness, did Palacio, Ruben Dario Palacio, who was the guy who was fighting from the Dominican Republic, neither did he notice. And so Colin turned southpaw, or, you know, to lead with the other hand, and the other guy turned with him, and both looking a bit perplexed. Colin perplexed because he couldn't know why he didn't seem to be using his hand. The other guy thinking, why is he pretending that he can't hit me and what's happening? And then, so I just rushed over to the corner and said to Howard, the trainer, who'd also noticed, and I said, you know, got to stop it. And Howard was already stopping it, and he chucked the towel in. And then Colin said, why did you do that? And he got back to the corner and then looked down at his arm and started, he's obviously convulsed in pain. But in the old days, they'd have bunged the shoulder back in and sent him out there for the next round, which is just a horrendous thought.
Now, were you confident that you were doing the right thing when you got the fight called?
I don't think, if you had time to think within the skewed logic of boxing, it probably was the wrong thing, as several people told me afterwards. You know, they came out, you know, if you'd waited out the round, John, he'd still be champ.
Do you think that's true?
I don't know. I mean, what happened if the guy, there was still 25 seconds, which is a long time in boxing, you know, for the guy to realise he had nothing to hold him off with. And so, you know, that way he got an immediate rematch. And he could have won the title back. But unfortunately, the shoulder never healed. So maybe I did do the wrong thing. But Colin, I don't know. But what would you do? Maybe I hadn't been
in boxing
long enough.
I probably wouldn't have been there in the first place, frankly. So it's hard for me to say.
Yeah. No, but put it this way. Neither me, myself, nor the trainer, Howard, who was a very experienced boxing man, we thought there was no question of not pulling him out at that stage. No, boxing's hard enough without going in there one-handed.
Was Colin angry with you that, in retrospect, that you'd call the fight?
No, he knew he couldn't go, since he saw what the state of his shoulder was.
You took him to the hospital right away, and you say in your book that you were looking at him in the hospital as he waited hours and hours for a doctor, and he was all hunched up in his green and gold shorts with his leaking face and his arm hanging out, and you say, and I finally understood. And then the chapter ends, and I'm thinking, understood what? What is it that you finally understood?
Well, that actually was referring back to a conversation that Colin and I had in the very early days when he was still a prospect, and I was fairly kind of looking through boxing with rose-tinted spectacles, and I used to read all the trade magazines and talk about left jabs and right hooks and all with that combo, this, that, and good defense, good offense. And I remember Colin saying to me right at that early stage, he says, you can talk about boxing all you want, John, but at the end of the day, what it is a fight. And that's what I understood, is that this is the brutality of it, I suppose, which perhaps it should have been blindingly obvious to anyone. But there is a it is obscured beneath layers of sort of mythology and discussion of styles, and particularly now statistics and punch stat things. But at the end of the day, what boxing is two people fighting each other, and until someone else stops them, or one of them is rendered unconscious.
Well, when you were watching Colin Sweet C. McMillan in the hospital, knowing that his career was probably about to end, did it change your mind about boxing? Did you start to feel different about the sport?
It changed me. Yes, it did. Because I think that when you're with a prospect like that, and I sincerely believe, just as I'm sure Mike Tyson believed, and the people behind Mike Tyson believed, and like this new guy here, Prince Nazim Hamed, and his people, on the way up, he was one of those fighters, you just thought he was untouchable. He used to come into that old MC Hammer song, you know, Can't Touch This. And that was his choice. And it was very apt. And I couldn't see anyone beating him. He couldn't see anyone beating him. Howard couldn't see anyone beating him. He was one of those fighters. You just couldn't see. It wasn't only you couldn't see him losing on a title. No one was getting a round off him. I mean, on his way up to the world title, I don't think he lost a round in his previous 10, 11 fights. And it was a tremendous sobering up for all of us. And I think being personally involved like that, obviously it changes your perspective. And I think it was the, you know, being that close to it. You know, I think, yes, it's inevitable that you will, something will be, will move you about it, and you're going to be much more ambivalent about putting someone in that situation again.
What did Sweet C. McMillan end up doing after his boxing career ended?
He's doing really well. He's trained, against my advice, to be a journalist. And he's doing a course at the moment. And he also has a club down in the East End of London where he does one night a week DJing down there. And he's doing really well.
And what have you been doing? Writing?
I've been writing. Still see his trainer, Howard. But I don't really see anyone else from boxing.
Jonathan Rendell's new boxing memoir is called This Bloody Mary is the Last Thing I Own. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Rendell, author of the new boxing memoir, This Bloody Mary is the Last Thing I Own. Rendell spent 5 years managing the career of Colin Sweet C. McMillan, who held the world featherweight title for about 6 months in 1992. Rendell is also a journalist who has written extensively about boxing. When your career as a boxing manager ended, you just went back into journalism in a more full-time way, and you ended up writing investigative stories largely about boxing. And that's when you realized that there were perhaps more threats going on outside of the ring than in the ring. What were some of the stories you were writing that were getting people really angry with you?
Well, I tried to write try to monitor the boxing scene from the point of view in the way that a journalist would, say, cover financial stories. Or even soccer stories, which are really big and equivalent to, I suppose, American football over there, whatever. In a sort of correct journalistic manner. And I found out this was totally impossible because you just got banned from covering the fights. And also, it's such a hall of mirrors, boxing, and there's the allegiances are shifting all the time, and enemies are friends the next week, that even though you know a story to be true, you know, and you got everything together and you printed it, you would then, even with the most innocuous story in this country, would be bombarded by libel writs. Because I think of per capita, boxing promoters, both here and in the States, I think, are, you know, the most voracious litigants of libel in the world. I'm confident that's true, you know, by some margin. And that's the way, and it sort of imprints itself on editors' minds, and they don't really want to know. And also there's the other problem with boxing is that you spend a year discovering corruption in boxing, and at the end of the day, people probably thought it was already corrupt in the first place.
That's a good point, isn't it? Yeah, well, listen, dating back to all the, like, early classic boxing movies, everybody knew, you know, that's what was always shown as the corruption.
Yeah, that's right. And Raging Bull, which is my favorite movie, which is a great story of it, really.
Were there a lot of threats against you when you were functioning as a reporter investigating the boxing world?
Yes, there were threats, and I think most of them were probably all just baloney, really. But after a while, it starts weighing down on you, and you start becoming a bit paranoid. I just thought, in the end, what's the point? And I spent 4 years fighting one particular libel case, which thankfully, we fought and didn't give in, and it was finished. But after that, I thought, you know, what's the point?
When did you realize that you were no longer in love with the world of boxing?
It was during the year when Colin's shoulder was healing, and I'd spent quite a lot of time out in Vegas and covering fights. And I just remember, and I had I just got fed up with the, I suppose confused, really, would be the word, by the fact that nothing was what it seemed in boxing, and what seemed was nothing, and you really couldn't get to anything. And it seemed to me, the boxers suddenly appeared to me as absolutely the heroes of it, which they are. And, but it's the same story in boxing, really. I mean, you can take any one boxer, champion boxer, and you'll probably find, almost certainly find, that 10 to 15 years after he's retired, he's not in a good state, either financially or health-wise, usually both. And And you watch these young men entering this ride, and it just seems doomed. And you, in the end, you just don't want to be a witness to it anymore.
Has the world of boxing changed a lot from when you first fell in love with it to now?
I think it's changed a lot. I think in this country, at least, it's really dying on its feet.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, without getting too boring, all the number of titles there are now is ridiculous. And the whole structure of boxing...
So you think they've lost their meaning because there's so many of them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, we used to be able to name every world champion. Even though, and there were two then, I think. That was always a bit of annoying at the time, you know, that there were two. Every other sport had one, but boxing had two. But we still knew both of them. But now there's five, six, seven, I don't know how many there are now. And the titles have become meaningless. And it's just a sort of, I mean, you had the ridiculous situation of an English fighter, Prince Nazim Hamed, going to New York, I think, a few months ago, fighting a New Yorker and being the attraction. But being the attraction based on a huge Madison Avenue advertising campaign. I think they spent something like $10 million on the marketing for that fight. So it must be fairly desperate. But the problem is that however much one knocks promoters, and they should be knocked, they, like the boxers, have been broke themselves, or some promotion has bust them. And so the last thing they're going to do when they've got the chance of a TV day with some bogus title because the TV company wants a title, is tell them that the title is bogus. You know, they just want the payday. And that's the sort of mindset that they carry into it. So it's complete short-termism in boxing. And the result has been that the structure, the public, I believe, have become confused by it, even those that have carried on with it. And what has been most noticeable has been the decline in column inches in newspapers about boxing, where it really only it's the big heavyweight fights that will get a mention now. Whereas when I started 10 years ago, we were covering everything.
Now, I know you had one dealing with probably the world's most famous promoter, Don King. Mm. Tell us about the contract that he offered.
It's a very interesting contract. It was a completely blank piece of paper with a dotted line at the bottom for Colin to sign. And we're in his New York offices. It was East 69th Street or something. And he wanted to sign this blank piece of paper. And I said, well, he can't sign that, Don. And Don King said that it was just, the only thing was it was just the figures were too big to put on the paper. That was the only problem. And that, you know, the only way of really equating the sort of figures he was talking about for Sweet Sue McMillan was to look up at the clouds outside his office. We all looked out the window. And he said, you see that cloud there, and the money, you know, it's the sort of money that can only be transposed on the clouds, and it can't really be kind of distilled down onto this bit of paper because it's too big. So just sign there. But thankfully he didn't sign. We managed to get out of New York.
Do you think it's possible to really have a boxing career as a boxer or as a manager and stay clean?
As a boxer, yes. I think you're not... Yeah, I think you can, but you're doomed. That's the price you pay. As a manager, I think if you have more than one fighter ever, then you are... It's impossible.
And why is it impossible?
Because if once you have a stable, you're going to have to start judging, well... If he wins, you know, if you've got two fighters, you see, and you say, well, if he wins, well, how will it affect his career? So I don't want him to win too well. Or, you know, you're going to have things in your mind weighing up. You'll be balancing the career of one fighter against the needs of the other when you're dealing with a promoter. So whenever you fight a promoter, you're dealing with a promoter. You might you might not get the best deal for the second fighter you've got because it might jeopardize your deal with you've already got for the fighter, your first fighter. That sort of thing. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, you were briefly a boxer yourself when you were in college.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you when you were in the ring and you were giving and getting the blows?
Mm.
Did you have a taste for that?
I certainly didn't after to be, but I didn't actually really feel them. I thankfully, we were so inexpert at it, both myself, I think, and the opponent, that they couldn't really do any serious damage. They were just sort of thudding. I was aware of myself. It was more like a sort of dance. I seem to remember just hugging onto him after about the first. And there again, didn't even reach the end of the second, so didn't have to have long to wait. But no, it was a very odd experience. Very odd. I couldn't speak afterwards. That's all I remember. I was trying to speak. I was trying to tell the trainer and everything what had happened and why I'd lost. And they were looking at me with this sort of strange expression. And I realized that I was speaking, that absolutely no words were coming out.
Was that for physical or psychological reasons?
Well, it was either from a punch on the throat or I don't know which. I sort of resumed my speech a bit, you know, about that, you know, soon afterwards. And then left the arena as quickly as possible.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Rendell's new boxing memoir is called This Bloody Mary Is the Last Thing I Own.